morning is United States against Kern.
Your Honors, good morning.
Good morning to those here.
Good morning, Counsel. Your Honors, the case of bar is really a fairly simple one. Factually speaking, Mr. Kern, a part owner of Altamonte, a new Chevrolet, engaged in a fraud. The fraud occurred beginning January 1998, continued through March of 2000. The fraud specifically involved the sales of automobiles on credit to people not credit worthy. Altamonte Chevrolet served as the primary lender to these persons purchasing the automobiles, but in preparing the documentation so as to enable Altamonte to immediately sell or forward the loan to the secondary lenders, a credit application was filled out. As part of the scheme here, the false information enhancing incomes, diminishing expenses, allowing for a scoring system that the secondary lender had to accept the loans was invoked so as to enable the primary lender, Altamonte, to receive the benefit of the loan.
Mr. Levin, I have two questions for you, actually, though. One of them has to do with how you're going to get around the waiver of the appeal. And secondly, sort of a short part of that is it's not clear to me that Mr. Kern wants to simply withdraw the entire guilty plea. It seems like he wants to pick and choose. You know, he wants to be able to appeal, but not to lose the other benefits that he received in his guilty plea, and I really don't think this appeal can go much further if there is, in fact, a waiver.
Your Honor, thank you for the question. The Lilly case, I think, speaks to how a guilty plea admonishment is taken when there is to be a waiver. And incidentally, the waiver in this case goes not only to waiver of appellate rights, it also goes to waiver of
guilty plea. Which is quite common, yeah.
Right, and it's
one of the initial questions. What I share with Judge Wood is, does your client want to withdraw his plea? He can't appeal the sentence without withdrawing his plea because we've held that the two go together. The whole plea stands or the whole plea falls. You can't evade clauses you don't like. If your client withdraws his plea, the very first thing that happens is he loses plea levels for acceptance of responsibility. Next thing that happens is he loses the prosecutor's agreement to limit the time period over which the loss is calculated.
Yeah.
So your client will be, as far as I can see, unambiguously worse off if he withdraws his plea. Does he understand that? Does he really want to do this?
He does not wish to withdraw the plea. He wishes, though, that there be address.
No, sorry. As soon as you say that, this appeal is over. He cannot avoid the appeal waiver without withdrawing the plea of guilty. We held that in the Wenger case.
I'm familiar with the Wenger case, Your Honor. The problem that my client was faced with was that notwithstanding the arguments that the court was improperly applying the guidelines, that he would lose his right to appeal just that part of the sentence. And I understand the Wenger case. If Your Honors are saying that, of course, that the Wenger case controls such that he can't get that benefit, then perhaps he should be in a position to withdraw the plea. With that, I get to consult
him. I think the time for that is past. You need to tell us whether your client wishes to withdraw the whole plea. Now, the burden of your argument that the plea is involuntary and based on ineffective assistance suggests that the plea is defective, and that event is withdrawn, and all the benefits are lost. The point is, there's no way you can have the benefits of the plea and escape the detriment. It just doesn't work that way.
The biggest problem, it seems to me, is that the stipulation as to the loss amount favored Mr. Kern in the sense that as time passed, more people might default on the loans, and that would have resulted in a loss figure that could have been worse than the one agreed to. I have another question, and that is whether or not you really want to pursue your ineffectiveness claim now rather than reserve it for collateral review, because it seems to me that we might need a more developed record as to what Mr. Kern's attorney below advised him as, you know, with respect to his plea in order to fully assess whether or not, I think it was Mr. Halpern was, you know, what was ineffective.
if I may first, it could not have been raised by further defaulted loans. In fact, the likelihood is that it would have gone the other way. At the $209,000, it would have had to have gone to $350,000. Most of these loans were already dead, meaning honored or defaulted by that time. And you're right, Your Honor, the problem was the stipulation. And the issue on the ineffective assistance is if that stipulation, which is inaccurate, binds our client, and if he is deemed to have waived the appellate rights, then, of course, it's ineffective. At least that's the argument.
What do you mean, of course? Let me try to put Judge Rogan's question a different way, because it's one I often ask in these divisions. If you want to argue now ineffective assistance of counsel, we have to judge on the current record. The current record doesn't show the reasons for counsel's strategy, and therefore it is an argument that cannot possibly succeed. This court has been in existence for 102 years. The number of ineffective assistance claims that have succeeded on direct appeal in those 102 years is zero. This will not be the first.
Well, it doesn't sound
like it. If you pursue it, however, it cannot later be raised on collateral attack on an expanded record.
The problem
is, it's something you really want to do.
The problem for us, Your Honor, was obviously if we were to lose the 2 points for acceptance, we'd rather be here on plain error than having and raised it here in a record that probably wouldn't change with another extrinsic hearing on collateral attack.
If you agree that there's no more to put into the record, we'll go ahead and hear it, but if there's no more to put in the record, then it's not a claim that can possibly succeed.
The
problem.
I do see the problem, Your Honor. I do see the problem.
And you appear to have agreed with, although I don't want to put words in your mouth, so you can tell me if I'm wrong, but Judge Easterbrook has outlined a couple of advantages in this plea agreement that did accrue to Mr. Kern. Maybe not as many as he might have liked, but it's not an unambiguously bad agreement for him. He has some pluses, and that would tend to suggest that perhaps his lawyer was doing a reasonable job for him.
He got no pluses, respectfully, Your Honor. Had he gone in bled blind on this case, he would have gotten the acceptance of responsibility, he would have got the timely acceptance of responsibility, the issues that the government raised.
That's relevant conduct, period.
The period of time, as I suggest, in response to Judge Rosner's question, could not possibly have gone up at that time that the true economic loss was being determined, because actual loss or intended loss was already such that it could not have gone to the next level of $350,000, meaning we were at the lowest end of the economic amount that would have allowed for any increase or decrease. So that was no benefit. The government contention that we got benefit just wasn't there. There was no consideration in this play. He would have done better if his lawyer had not stipulated to a lost amount, but had simply come in and pled him guilty, because then he would have got the full benefit of the acceptance of responsibility, the timely acceptance of responsibility. What we risk here, and Judge Easterbrook is right, if we seek to withdraw our plea, we risk what might be 3 levels or 9 more months on a sentence that we think is egregious, because this gentleman is being compared to someone who, as if he had gone in to try and steal the full 290,000.
You're very lucky. You risk that just by filing an appeal. We held in the United States against Hare that a defendant breaches a plea agreement by filing a notice of appeal after having promised not to do so, forfeits any acceptance for reduction, any reduction for acceptance of responsibility, if the U.S. attorney so requests. You're very lucky that the U.S. attorney didn't so request.
Again, Your Honor, respectfully, I think all we're asking is that the district court be held to proper application of the guidelines. The stipulation was inappropriate to the $209,000 loss. That's what created the situation. And of course, the plea agreement we don't believe was breached, because in the plea agreement it's recited that the figures are preliminary in nature, either party can correct, and that's what we attempted to do when we came back. Of course, we were not the attorneys who entered into that plea agreement. I'll take whatever time I have left for the
Mr. Littleton. Ms. Littleton.
Please, the court. There is a valid appellate waiver in this case that bars the defendant from raising the claims before this court.
Ms. Middleton, my question is right where Mr. Levitt left off. There certainly can be a valid waiver of appeal rights that covers some issues and not others. For example, we have held in some cases that even if you agree not to appeal on your sentence, you can still appeal on a restitution matter.
Right.
And what Mr. Levitt was arguing at the end is essentially contained within this plea agreement was a reservation of the right to contest certain calculations that pertain to the sentence. If that's true, then he's still comfortably inside the plea agreement and we can reconcile all of this. If that's not true, then I certainly agree. We have a lot of cases that say appellate waivers are enforceable.
That's not true. The plea agreement permitted the defendant to raise errors in calculation in the plea agreement and permitted the court to consider those and to render a final decision as to the defendant's sentence.
Yes, but if you look at counsel's statements at the change of plea during that colloquy, they're troubling because counsel's statements suggest that he meant to reserve the right to litigate the loss issue at the time of sentencing. And the stipulations that are included in the plea agreement obviously impeded that effort. So the loss opportunity might have made a difference in his case because, reimbursement to victims by third parties can serve as a basis for downward departures, which would more accurately have reflected the economic realities of the crime here.
Right. And in this case, the defendant did reserve the right to raise that issue at sentencing. And the government did not contest his ability to do that. But the district court clearly fulfilled its responsibility, its independent duty to evaluate whether or not that loss calculation was calculated correctly, and it fulfilled that duty. It considered all of the evidence that the defendant put forward, the expert testimony, as well as briefing by both sides, as well as oral argument by both sides on the issue. And the district court, in fact, stated on the record that it considered all of this evidence and that it found that the loss amount that was stipulated to in the plea agreement was not unreasonable or based on a misunderstanding of the totality of the defendant's fraud. The court also considered whether or not it should grant a downward departure for both the economic realities of the situation, and it did not decide to do that. But the loss calculation itself, the court considered the issue and determined that it was correct, and that is in fact correct under the law in this circuit. Actual loss is the amount outstanding in the loans at the time the fraud is discovered, subtracting from that the amount of the assets pledged as collateral. In this case, that's exactly what the court did. It took the amount outstanding on the 22 defaulted loans and subtracted the value of the vehicles that had been pledged as collateral. Now, what the defendant wanted at that time was to deduct or to, for the court to consider the fact that there was this buyback provision in the loan agreement, and that would have reduced the loss amount, what the defendant claims, to approximately zero because the lenders would have been fully reimbursed. The problem with that argument is that it is foreclosed by U.S. versus Wayne. In that case, this court held that third-party guarantees unsupported by additional collateral are not assets pledged to secure a loan. They are simply guarantees, not securities. And in this case, that's exactly what we have. We have a buyback provision from the dealership to buy back any loans that go into default from the lenders. That agreement is not supported by any additional collateral, and therefore the district court properly excluded it from its consideration in whether or not the loss calculation was correct. And once the court made that decision that the stipulated amount was in fact correct and sentenced the defendant was precluded by the plea agreement from appealing that decision. And as for the concessions that the defendant received that counsel has raised, the defendant received significant concessions from the government in this case. First of all, the government agreed to acceptance of responsibility and reducing the defendant's base offense level by 3 points. secondly, the government agreed not to seek an enhancement for an offense involving sophisticated means. And more importantly, the government agreed to freeze the loss amount as of March 28, 2000, at $209,000. And what that did, the reason that is a significant concession, is it relieved the defendant of the risk that the loss amount could go higher before sentencing, and it gave certainty as to the restitution amount. And then finally, the government charged one count in this case when it could have charged 22. Because of those four things, the government gave significant concessions to the defendant in support of his appellate waiver and this plea agreement. If the court has no further questions.
Are you arguing that the district court was correct when it identified the intended loss as $1.4 million? Is that your argument?
When it identified the intended loss?
Mm-hmm.
No, Your Honor, I'm actually not arguing intended loss because the district court in this case did not base its decision on intended loss. It was based on actual loss, which is what the government argued and what the evidence showed.
Because you realize the district court was wrong about the intended loss of 1.4. Because Mr. Kern didn't receive a break on that issue, intended loss would be the unsecured
exactly.
The original loan amount, and here the loans were collateralized, at least in part, by the automobiles at the time of the original loan.
You're correct, Your Honor.
It couldn't have been the full amount.
Right, and that's why the district court calculated actual loss.
Well, the district court did both, I guess. The district court was certainly wrong about the intended loss.
Right. The government respectfully requests that this court determine that the appellate waiver is valid, that the court enforce the waiver, and affirm the defendant's sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Williams. Jason, further, Mr. Leonard?
Just briefly. Again.
That's guaranteed.
Your Honor, no benefit was received by Mr. Kern by the government. I would note, too, the appellate waiver, as was remarked on in Rayburn and other cases, is unilateral. The government could appeal. My client could not if that waiver is acknowledged. There's a shifting of the burden in this case. The $209,000 was presented by way of a probation report that came in the government's version. The probation office accepted that. When there was the extrinsic hearing and a CPA qualified and who was not rebutted and who was otherwise credible suggested the loss was less and gave reasons, nothing came in to suggest that the loss was anything but zero. Whose burden is it? Under United States versus Schneider, the Faulkner's case, you know, the bonus points only should be added if the government assumes the burden and earns them, meaning the $209,000. There was no loss.
Thank you, Mr. Levin.
Thank you.
The case will be